Hi guys, this is the Center for Constitutional Rights. Thank you so much for joining us for this briefing call about the Communications Management Units. We'll be started in just 30 seconds or so. What we'll do is we'll be doing a presentation of some of the information that we've emailed you about, and then we'll follow things up with a Q&A session. For anybody that's dialing in, you can send us in any questions you may have to the following email address, cmu@ccrjustice.org. We'll also be attempting to record the call for anybody that was unable to join at this time and provide it to them at a future date. So thanks again. We'll be starting in about 20 seconds to allow a couple more folks to join. Any questions, send us an email at cmu@ccrjustice.org. Thanks to everyone that's joining us today. This is Nahal Zamani, and I'm the Advocacy Program Manager with the Center for Constitutional Rights. I'm joined by two of my colleagues, Alexia Gathokleos and Rachel Mirapol, both of whom are staff attorneys with CCR and who filed our legal challenge against the Communications Management Units, or the CMUs. Today, we want to walk you through the documents that we were able to recently make public through our lawsuit. Which overwhelmingly reveal that the prisoners at the CMUs have been denied due process at every step. There's a lot of information that we'll try to present on the call, so we're going to try to do our best to keep our portion of a call to the presentation under 30 minutes. There will be a Q&A session afterwards, and so what we've done is we've set up an email address. Send those questions to cmu@ccrjustice.org. So we know a number of you on this call are already familiar with the CMUs, but I'm going to provide a really quick overview of some of the key facts about these units. Then Rachel and Lexi will walk you through some of the key findings that we were recently able to make public. The CMUs are unusually restrictive units, where select prisoners are barred for years at a time from all but the most constrained communications with the outside world, without the opportunity to understand or rebut the rationale for their placement. Courts have already recognized that other than ADX, the CMUs are the most restrictive facilities in the federal prison system. The CMUs have been shrouded in secrecy since they were quietly opened. CMUs impose sharp restrictions on the duration, frequency, and nature of social telephone calls, visits, and written correspondence. All of the calls and visits must be in English. There is a blanket ban on any physical contact during social visits. And for all calls on all visits at the CMU, they're live monitored, and in all areas, they are also audio surveilled. CMU prisoners are isolated as well from other prisoners at all times. And CMUs are used as a substitute for disciplinary process, where a prisoner might ordinarily have been entitled to a hearing where they could challenge allegations of misconduct. Our documents show that prisoners were simply sent to these CMU units instead of providing them with this process.
So in April of 2010, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a federal civil rights lawsuit challenging policies and conditions at the CMUs. Now, we initially brought a series of claims challenging the harsh restrictions at these units and alleging that the Bureau of Prisons was disproportionately sending Muslim prisoners to the CMUs. Those claims were unfortunately dismissed by the district court, but the court refused to dismiss our procedural due process claim, which challenges the procedures the Bureau of Prison uses to send and keep people at the CMUs. We've engaged in 2 years of discovery, and we've demanded and reviewed thousands of documents. We deposed BOP officials around the country, all in an attempt to get to the bottom of these secretive units. So over the past few months, we've been able to submit all that evidence that we gathered to the court to prove our case. And for the first time, we've been able to disclose and discuss this evidence with the public.
So on this call, what we were hoping to do was share a lot of that factual detail with you, so bear with us. It's a lot of information. And part of why we're doing this is until now, as has been indicated, these units have been so shrouded in secrecy. You know, people don't know how they've ended up there, and they don't know how to get out. Now, obviously, our lawsuit was designed to bring these facts to light, but sharing this information with you here today is part of our effort to change the secrecy surrounding the CMUs. Now, this lack of information about the CMUs has even shaped how the BOP talks about and describes the units. So as you may know, publicly the government refers to CMUs as self-contained general population units. And they've used that characterization to argue that because there's nothing unique or unusual about the CMUs, prisoners aren't constitutionally entitled to any process before being placed there. But documents that we obtained through this litigation reveal that this is just doublespeak. Internal BOP documents reveal that the BOP doesn't actually characterize the CMUs as general population units, but categorizes them along with ADX, which is the federal supermax facility, and SMUs. These are called special management units. They're specialized and highly restrictive discipline units. Now, one of the extraordinary things that we found out about the CMUs is how long prisoners languish there. Now, the BOP, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, hasn't articulated any expected duration of CMU designation. And so our clients and other CMU prisoners have served years at a time in this kind of restrictive environment, whether or not they've engaged in misconduct. So one of the things we did with the lawsuit was obtain information about every prisoner who has ever been in a CMU, and we uncovered statistics about how long they'd been there.
So we found that the shortest stint that any prisoner has ever served at a CMU before being transferred to a general population unit is 40 weeks. The next shortest stint is 79 weeks. 95 prisoners have spent more than 18 months or 72 weeks at a CMU without any disciplinary infraction, so without any rule violation. And 25 prisoners have spent more than 36 months or 144 weeks at the CMUs without a disciplinary infraction.
So obviously one of the things that we wanted to get to the bottom of is the criteria that the BOP is using to send people to the CMUs. What we discovered is that the BOP opened the CMUs back in 2006 without establishing any written criteria for CMU designation. The first policy document that described any criteria at all was issued a year after the first unit was opened, and all it said was that the CMU was used to house inmates who require enhanced monitoring of all communications with people in the community.
Now, the counterterrorism unit of the Bureau of Prisons is the BOP office that initially recommends prisoners for CMU designation. And the counterterrorism unit, the CTU, did eventually develop internal unwritten criteria for CMU placement. But those criteria actually changed to capture, after the fact, the type of prisoner who they ended up sending to the CMU, rather than vice versa. So instead of having criteria as a guide to rationalize decision-making about who should be sent to the CMU, instead the counterterrorism unit simply developed criteria to describe the people who were already being sent there. So what this means practically is that when prisoners were initially designated to the CMU, they couldn't compare the reasons they were given for their placement against any set criteria and thus have any argument that they didn't belong there.
So in 2009, BOP finally documented five formal CMU criteria. And these were criteria that staff were supposed to use when reviewing a CMU prisoner for a continued CMU designation. In other words, you're already there. These were criteria to decide whether you should be kept there. So to this day, there is no BOP policy document about BOP designation, explaining what criteria BOP staff are supposed to use to decide whether or not to send someone to the CMU in the first place, or how to apply that kind of criteria when making decisions.
So given that this has never been put into writing, it shouldn't be surprising that there's a lot of confusion within the Bureau of Prisons about what the CMU criteria actually is. And in fact, we found out that different BOP offices involved in different aspects of the CMU designation process actually use different criteria. And some BOP staff who are involved in this process don't use any criteria at all. So one of the problems with this sort of vague and uncertain criteria is that it's really allowed for a series of discriminatory designations to the CMU. So I think folks are all aware that there is a disturbing overrepresentation of Muslims within the CMU, and this has been true since the units were open. we were able to learn in discovery that out of 178 total CMU designations, 101 of those involved Muslim prisoners. So compared to a Muslim population within the Bureau of Prisons of approximately 6%, this is a vast overrepresentation. Now, the BOP has claimed that the large proportion of Muslims at the CMUs results from the CMU's focus on terrorism, but the statistics we found contradict this account.
Right. So 10 of the first 55 CMU prisoners were allegedly designated there because of communications-related issues, not terrorism. And what we know is that of those 10 initial designations, 8 people self-reported as Muslim. So in other words, terrorism can't explain away that significant overrepresentation. Now, as we indicated, unfortunately, the court already ruled that this overrepresentation we're seeing doesn't state a discrimination claim under the Constitution. But what the numbers do suggest is that the BOP has, from the start, disproportionately focused on Muslims when making CMU selections, and it underscores the sort of arbitrary decision-making that results from lack of criteria and lack of oversight.
So as our discovery in this case has shown, since the CMUs opened in 2006, designation and review of CMU prisoners has been marred by systemic failures at every level. You know, first and most fundamentally, perhaps, CMU prisoners aren't given meaningful notice about why they're being sent to the CMU.
So just to take a step back, what does notice mean? So the law requires that a prisoner who's placed in a segregation unit must be told the factual basis for that segregation and must be given a fair opportunity to rebut those reasons. That's what's called notice. And courts have recognized that it's among the most important procedural mechanisms to avoid erroneous designations to a restrictive prison unit like the CMU.
So as with criteria, the BOP has never put into writing sort of what the requirements of notice should be or the way that the designation process is supposed to work from beginning to end. This means that people involved in the process don't understand what happens at other steps in the process, and the BOP staff who actually run the communication management units don't know how or why prisoners are there. Now, what does happen consistently is that once a prisoner arrives at the CMU, after he arrives there, he's given a one-page notice to inmate of transfer. Now, each of these notices includes general information about the CMU and then has several prisoner-specific sentences which are supposed to notify the prisoner of the reason for their individual placement in the unit.
Right. So through discovery in our case, we reviewed dozens of these notices. What we found is that they completely fail to provide the information necessary to challenge your CMU designation. So first, and most fundamentally, the notice that you're given when you get to the CMU doesn't actually reflect the reason or reasons that you were in fact approved for CMU designation. So wrapping your mind around this requires some background in how the BOP is designating prisoners to the CMU. So pretty much anyone can recommend to send a prisoner to the CMU, a warden of a facility, a U.S. attorney, in other words, a federal prosecutor, or an FBI officer can suggest that someone go to a CMU. The CTU, the Counterterrorism Unit, then makes a recommendation to what's called the North Central Regional Office. This is the office that governs the region of the country where the CMUs are located. The director of that office, who's called the regional director, ultimately makes a final decision about whether or not someone should go to the CMU and why. So you might think that the regional director, the individual who makes the decision, would write the notice of transfer explaining why he decided to send someone to a CMU. But in actual fact, he doesn't do that. Instead, that notice is drafted by the CTU, the Counterterrorism Unit, based on the reasons they recommended CMU placement to begin with. In fact, what we ended up learning through this case is that the regional director doesn't write down his reasons for sending someone to the CMU anywhere, and that those reasons could be completely different than the reasons that the CTU recommended someone be sent to the CMU. So in other words, because he doesn't write the notice, what ends up in that notice to a prisoner doesn't actually reflect the actual final reason that the decision was made to send someone to the CMU. And there is no way to tell, beyond asking the regional director and relying on his memory, why an individual was actually approved for CMU designation. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, the CTU, which does draft this notice, doesn't actually have a policy or practice of including all the reasons for their recommendation on the notice. They just sometimes omit one of their rationales for recommending that someone goes to the CMU. So we asked them why, and their response was there's just not enough room on the form.
This is probably obvious, but notice that provides some but not all of the reasons for designation is simply insufficient, and this is for a clear reason. You know, a prisoner who might successfully challenge the reason listed on his notice wouldn't be released from the CMU. He could be retained there based on some unlisted reason that was the actual basis for his CMU placement that he never knew about and thus couldn't challenge. So, for example, Daniel McGowan is a former CMU prisoner and one of the plaintiffs in our case. Prior to his incarceration, he was very involved in environmental and other social justice activism, and he continued his activism when he was behind bars, writing about issues of concern and corresponding with other activists. So Daniel's notice of transfer states that his convictions and offense conduct are the reason for his CMU designation. But when we actually got to look at the counterterrorism unit memos recommending Daniel to be placed in the CMU, those memos reveal that the counterterrorism unit actually relied on Daniel's communications about environmental issues with lawful activists to justify putting him in the CMU. He was never disciplined for these communications or informed before this lawsuit that the communications were relevant to his CMU designation. He couldn't challenge the fact that he was sent to the CMU based on his lawful political correspondence because he was never told that that was the reason he was sent there.
Yeah, and what happened with Daniel's notice is fairly typical, actually. You know, troublingly, we've noticed that the information that's excluded from these notices is frequently related to a prisoner's religious or political views. And what that suggests to us is that CMU designation is often based on subjective ideological criteria that are just unreported to the prisoner. Now, a second issue is that the reasons that are listed on the notices are frequently so vague that they don't really provide a CMU prisoner with adequate information to challenge them. Now, another former CMU prisoner and former plaintiff in this case is Avon Twitty, and I think that his notice reflects this. So his notice when he got to the CMU just indicated that he was designated to the CMU because of involvement in recruitment and radicalization of other inmates. And we've seen a bunch of these. Others have received notices that parrot this language. So Mr. Twitty tried to find out, you know, who he was accused of recruiting, when, where, and toward what end, so that he could concretely refute those allegations. But he wasn't given any information in return at all, meaning that he couldn't effectively do that.
So moving on from notice, prisoners who are assigned to the CMU are also not given anything close to a meaningful hearing. Now, a prisoner who is facing transfer to a particularly restrictive unit, like the CMU, must receive at least some opportunity to present his views to the prison official charged with deciding whether to transfer him.
Right, but CMU prisoners don't receive any hearing at all or any other opportunity for meaningful input before they're sent to a CMU. Instead, what happens is that after you get to a CMU, you're told that you can appeal that transfer through the Bureau of Prisons Administrative Remedy Program. But as our clients and other CMU's prisoners' experiences demonstrate, use of that program cannot and does not result in any substantive reevaluation of whether you should be at a CMU. So we asked officials responsible for the process how they treat these grievances. And what we were told is they review the originally cited reasons for the prisoner's designation and then remind the prisoner of what those reasons are. What they don't do is actually reconsider those reasons, which is what obviously a real hearing would entail.
So another one of our plaintiffs' experience demonstrates this problem. Yasin Araf is another plaintiff in the case, and you know, he was the victim of an FBI sting. So arrest notice of transfer indicates that he was sent to the CMU because of his offense conduct, which the notice says included significant communication, association, and assistance to JEM, a terrorist group. But as his court documents show, Yassin Arif never actually had any contact with anyone from JEM. He had contact with an FBI informant who pretended to be connected to JEM so that the FBI could successfully prosecute terrorists. Now, in using the administrative remedy program, Arif told the BOP in the clearest possible terms, you know, the information on my notice simply is not true. I never had any communication with anyone from JEM, let alone significant communication, and you can look at my court documents to prove that. But the BOP never even acknowledged this contradiction and refused to look at the documents that Arif suggested.
So, you know, unsurprisingly, as a result of this fundamental failing to give prisoners a hearing, in our case, we forced the BOP to concede that not one single CMU prisoner has ever been released from the CMU through the administrative remedy program.
Along with notice and an opportunity to be heard, the third fundamental component of procedural due process is meaningful periodic review of the continued need for segregation in a unit like the CMU. Now, for the first 3 years that the CMUs operated, there was simply no review process in place to allow for transfer out of the unit. So not a single prisoner was transferred from the CMU to a non-CMU general population unit within that time period.
Right, but what's become clear is that CMU prisoners were lied to during this period. They were told that they would be considered for transfer out of the CMU after they'd been there for 18 months with clear conduct.
When actually this wasn't true at all. Now, really, the BOP had decided that CMU prisoners should stay in the CMU until there was a determination that their communications no longer required the level of monitoring that's allowed by the CMU, regardless of whether or not they had 18 months of clear conduct. But the BOP simply didn't put into place a system to make this determination until October of 2009, 3 years after the units opened. And at that point, it issued a memo that instituted reviews to come to this determination. But the BOP didn't want to acknowledge to prisoners that there was no system in place to transfer prisoners out. So instead, when some prisoners achieved 18 months of clear conduct and thought they were then going to be considered for a transfer, they were simply transferred to the other CMU. There's two units within the BOP. So they were transferred from one to the other and told that their 18-month clock was restarted. So the October 2009 memo that was finally issued was supposed to tell BOP staff that CMU prisoners should be reviewed for potential redesignation at every program review, which occurs every 6 months. But even then, the system has been rife with problems.
So some BOP employees who were responsible for these CMU reviews, including the wardens at both Marion and Terre Haute, which is where they're located, thought that this process only applied to the six-month program reviews after someone had had 18 months of clear conduct. But that's just incorrect. That wasn't the policy. And then institution supplements, which are documents that set forth official institution policy, still said for years that you needed 18 months of clear conduct before you could be considered for release from the CMUs.
So in other words, the prisoners were being told inaccurate information about when and how they might be considered for transfer. Now, currently, we know that the reviews that are happening sort of begin with a prisoner's unit team, which is tasked with determining whether continued CMU placement is still necessary, in part by looking at whether the original reasons for CMU placement still exist or have somehow been mitigated. I mean, the problem with this is that the unit team doesn't even have complete information about why a prisoner was sent to the CMU in the first place, so it can't determine whether the original reasons still exist. Moreover, CMU designation is frequently based on offense conduct or some sort of act within prison, and it's not clear how these kind of historical reasons could ever be found to no longer exist.
So, again, there was this fundamental lack of guidance for BOP staff. And so what we found is that members of the unit teams who were doing these reviews just ended up using their own individual discretion in applying these supposed guidelines. So the unit manager at the Marion CMU told us that He thought that if a prisoner could mitigate the reasons for his initial placement and earn transfer out by no longer believing in the ideology that motivated the activities that led to his placement to begin with. That doesn't appear anywhere in the criteria, obviously. And a Marion CMU official thought that an individual sent to the CMU for environmental extremism who continued to read extremist environmental publications qualified for continued CMU placement. Now, obviously, this is very troubling because if a unit team and a warden deny transfer, the process just ends there. There's no other level of review. That's it until your next program review.
Now, one of the very few pieces of the CMU review and designation process that the BOP has put into writing is that prisoners who are denied transfer from the CMU are supposed to be notified in writing about why they were denied. But the BOP simply doesn't do this. Instead, time and time again, prisoners who are denied transfer are just sent a form memo that doesn't provide any explanation for why they've been denied or what they have to do to earn their way out of the CMU. So prisoners simply can't, you know, challenge the outcomes of these reviews or change their behavior to earn release.
So another of our clients is a man named Kifa Jayusi, and he spent years in both the Terre Haute and Marion CMUs. And at one point, the unit team did recommend him for transfer out of CMU, and they invoked his clear conduct, the fact that he had good relationships with staff and other prisoners, and the warden agreed. So in that situation, what happens is that they make a recommendation to the CTU, the counterterrorism unit, which in turn issues a recommendation one way or another to the regional director who makes the final call. This is the same individual who decided whether you should go to the CMU in the first place. So in Mr. Jayusi's case, the CTU actually recommended against his transfer. And what it did was it wrote a memo to the regional director, including a substantial amount of information about a situation a couple of years before when Mr. Jayusi had led a prayer while he was at the Terre Haute CMU. And so what the CTU said in this memo was that it believed that this prayer that Mr. Jayusi had delivered was designed to radicalize other prisoners. And so the regional director just denied Mr. Jayusi's transfer. So Mr. Jayusi received a short memo informing him that his transfer had been denied, but he didn't get any explanation of why whatsoever. So in other words, he wasn't told that this years-old sermon had played any role at all in his continued CMU designation. He even filed an administrative remedy to find out why it had been denied, but he didn't get any information at all. So, as I said, he never knew that this prayer was among the reasons. Of course, this is very disturbing, as Mr. Jayusi was brought up on disciplinary charges for leading that prayer, but he was cleared of wrongdoing through the disciplinary process. In fact, the charge was expunged from his record.
In other words, CMU reviews are a sham. Some prisoners, like Jayusi and Aref, spend years on end in the CMU with clear conduct without being told why their transfer requests are denied. Others are retained there because they fail to change behavior they've never been told that they need to change. CMU prisoners receive no information about how long they can expect to spend in the CMU because the BOP has no expectation as to the appropriate duration of CMU placement.
So we're going to pause here to briefly mention next steps in our case, Aref v. Holder, and then start with our Q&A portion of the call. Please feel free to email any questions you might have to cmu@ccrjustice.org.
So as Nahal mentioned at the beginning of the call, we presented all this evidence and a lot more to the court in what's called a motion for summary judgment. We filed back in March. The BOP, the defendants in this case, have also moved for summary judgment, which we've opposed. And as of next week, the final brief in the case will be submitted. And basically what that means is the case will be before the court for decision one way or another. The two paths are this. Either the court will reach a decision on our claims, or it may order a trial in this case.
We feel good about the amount we've achieved so far. You know, we know that the BOP has paid close attention to this lawsuit. The documents we've seen have confirmed that. And the BOP has made some efforts to clean up its act, releasing dozens of prisoners from the CMU and instituting the meager review procedures that we've described. But none of this even comes close to bringing the processes up to the standards required by the law. And we're very hopeful that the court is going to consider all this evidence and agree with us that that's the case.
So if you're interested in our full submission to the court, we've posted it all online. It's available at www.ccrjustice.org/CMU. So again, that's ccrjustice.org/CMU. So as I said, our entire filing is there along with hundreds of previously unseen exhibits about the CMUs.
So we wanted to pause here to thank all of the activists, organizations, and allies who've been leading the challenges to challenge these units, and we're really appreciative for all of their hard work and very honored that you guys can join us on this call and have been working steadfast on this issue for a number of years. We're really excited about the opportunity to re-engage with you all on this critical issue, and we wanted to at least present some of the information that we were finally able to make public. What we'll do now is we'll transition into the Q&A portion of the call. So there's a number of folks on the call. So as we've noted, we have asked all questions to be emailed to cmu@ccrjustice.org. Thanks to the two individuals that already sent in their questions. The first question that we did get was regarding that 2009 BO policy. And the individual asked, is that document public and what does it really say?
The 2009 memo, which outlines these criteria that are purportedly used for the reviews and purportedly also apply to initial designations, was one of the exhibits in our case. So it's on the website at that address that I supplied, along with the rest of the policy documents that we were able to disclose.
And, you know, what the memo does, basically, is it sets forth a process for the BOP to review the need for continued CMU designation. And in doing so, it instructs the unit team to consider whether the reasons for initial CMU placement still exist. And then it goes on to list 5 reasons, right? And those reasons include things like the offense conduct or conviction involves some connection to terrorism or some association with a terrorist group. It includes individuals who contact the victims of their crimes or engage in repeated communications violations while in prison. Unsurprisingly, it also includes a catch-all. Basically, if the BOP thinks there any other reason to require the type of communications monitoring that the CMU allows. So in other words, the criteria is anything that the BOP thinks is important as to whether someone should go to a CMU. Now, the BOP says that that is the official CMU criteria, even though it's only set forth in a memo that describes the way the BOP should consider if someone can be released from the CMU.
Great. Now we're going to go on to our second question that we've received. We were asked, how do conditions at the CMUs compare to the Supermax facilities?
So CMUs are different important ways than Supermax facilities, but share some features in common. So, obviously, to the extent that people are familiar with Supermax facilities, these are lockdown units, and what that means is basically you're in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day. Now, the CMU isn't a solitary confinement unit. In fact, day-to-day life in the CMU doesn't really look like that. You are allowed to leave your cell and to communicate with other prisoners at the CMU, et cetera. But what is unique about the CMU, number one, is the enormously restrictive conditions, communications restrictions, that in some cases are actually worse than Supermax. So, for example, prisoners at ADX get fairly significantly more visiting time than do prisoners at the CMU. I think what's uniquely stigmatizing about the CMU is that it has been described very publicly as a terrorist unit. The United States Attorney General has referred to it as such, and so it sort of has that stigmatizing function. And what we do know based on the experience of our clients and other prisoners is even when they are eventually transferred from a CMU back to general prison population, they're subject to more restrictions than other prisoners and treated differently than other prisoners. So, for example, one CCR client has been told that even though he's in general population, he can't lead prayer or answer any questions from any other prisoners about Islam. And these are restrictions that just don't apply to other prisoners. So I think that there are some similarities to harsh units like supermaxes, but that the CMU really is unique.
Again, the email address to reach us to send us any questions is cmu@ccrjustice.org. Thanks to the folks that send in their questions. The next one that we have is asking about, what about the people that are sent to the CMUs for their political activities or their activism? What do the documents really reveal?
Well, it seems pretty clear that one of the ways people end up in the CMU is if the counterterrorism unit of the BOP is concerned about the individual's sort of political, ideological, or religious views, and see this individual as someone who has the capacity to sort of share those views, infect others in the prison population with these ideas, that the CMUs are really about containing what the BOP considers dangerous thoughts and ideology. But as we alluded to earlier, prisoners aren't told that that's why they're being sent to the CMU. They're not given any guidance as to sort of the way they might change their communications to earn their way out. And as we mentioned earlier with respect to our client Daniel McGowan, you know, his experience shows that, you know, he really had to guess at the reason why he was sent to these units. He didn't have any disciplinary violations in the low-security prison where he began to serve his sentence. And so when he was transferred to the CMU purportedly because of his offense conduct, you know, it was pretty clear from the beginning that that simply wasn't true, especially because his notice of transfer actually misstated his offense conduct. They got it wrong. We were able to learn in discovery that it seems as though they simply cut and pasted his notice with another notice that was used for a co-defendant of his. And so they rely on this sort of erroneous information as a cover to really limit his ability to continue to communicate on sort of political issues. And we've seen a pattern of that in terms of CMU designations.
So I'll wait for some more questions to come in, again, to cmu@ccrjustice.org. I will tell you a little bit about some of the upcoming opportunities that are coming up on the horizon. So there is an upcoming opportunity before the United Nations. The U.S. government ratified this international treaty, which is calls on the government to take proactive steps to eliminate racial discrimination. It's known as CERD. And every couple of years, any government or country that signs on to this and ratifies this treaty has to report on how they're doing. It's almost like a progress report before an independent body of human rights experts. So this August, the U.S. government is up to report on how they are complying with this international treaty around racial discrimination. And because we want to make sure that the committee has all the information at their fingertips, we've drafted a short report to them talking about the communications management units and saying how the government is discriminating against Muslims and their designations to these units, and highlighting our concerns around due process. We've just reported, we've just posted that report online, and that's provided to any folks that RSVP'd. You can find it on our website. We also want to continue to educate the public and share this valuable information with many of the communities that you all engage with regularly. So please feel free to reach out to Nahal, that's me, if you'd like to host any affected family members or prisoners to come to an event that you might be organizing and or have someone from CCR come and speak. Again, you can reach me at nzamani@ccrjustice.org or at cmu@ccrjustice.org. We'll be happy to talk about how we can collaborate.
So a question just came in where someone was just asking us to repeat where they can get all these documents and the examples that we cited. So again, it's all posted at www.ccrjustice.org/CMU. So you'll find our entire court filing there and pretty much every exhibit, which numbers in the hundreds, unfortunately, that we filed in the case.
And if you want that short briefing guide, if you weren't emailed it in advance of the call, feel free to drop a line to cmu@ccrjustice.org, and we'll definitely send along the document. And that's definitely something that can be photocopied back-to-back and provided at any educational events that you might be hosted. We just got another question. And the question is, have there been any arguments made that not allowing inmates to leave the CMUs until they've renounced or stopped publicly professing religious beliefs or practices violates the First Amendment?
That's a great question. Yeah, there is, in fact, a First Amendment retaliation claim in this case. We haven't focused on that on this call today because it's specific to one of our plaintiffs. Obviously, the due process challenge that we've brought is to the entire process by which prisoners are chosen for CMU designation and then are reviewed. So that's obviously an issue that will affect everyone at the CMU. But because we have seen sort of suppression of First Amendment activity at the CMU and use of the CMU to retaliate against prisoners who have engaged in political activism or have engaged in religious speech, we have brought a First Amendment claim, and so that is also currently before the court. And what that claim focuses on is the fact that decision-making about keeping people at the CMU is frequently made based on the content of their speech.
So just one distinction there is that we haven't affirmatively sought summary judgment on that claim because we think it's actually a factual issue as to why the decision makers are sending people to the CMU. Is it based on, as we believe and as we believe the documents show, on their religious speech or their political speech, or is it instead for some other legitimate purpose? That's a factual issue that we believe needs to be determined at trial. Now, the Bureau of Prisons has sought summary judgment on our retaliation claim, and we've opposed that. So if the court agrees with us, then we will go to trial on that claim probably sometime next year.
So we wanted to thank you all for listening. We know this has been a lot of information to download, and this is just the first part, we think, of an educational effort by CCR to share this, what we view as really critical information, to the public. And we really are looking forward to getting that into your hands in a digestible format, working with all of you as we have in the past to think about how we can build on any efforts that you might be doing in terms of organizing in your communities, thinking about ways that we can educate lawmakers and elected officials around this. And of course, we hope that you can tune in for the review of the U.S. government in mid-August with how it's complying with its obligations under CERD, which is also known as the International Treaty Around Eliminating Racial Discrimination. So thanks again to everybody who's dialed in. Again, if you need any information, you can visit ccrjustice/CMU or ccrjustice/CMU-documents, which is a special webpage set around these documents that came out earlier this year. We really want to thank you again for all of your activism and work, and we look forward to engaging with you over the next couple of months and throughout the fall especially. Thanks so much, and have a good day.